Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is now called to order. Today is Friday, May 7th, 2021. The time is 1:35, and we're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, Senator Myers, Senator Hughes, and myself, Chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy and Nate. Nancy's our recording secretary, and Nate's our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. First up today, the first item of today's calendar is House Bill 109, which would extend the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association deadline date. This is the second hearing of HB 109 in the Senate, and we previously closed public testimony on May 5th. At the last meeting, Director Bailey was going to provide today the committee an update on a meeting scheduled for Thursday, May 6th. That was yesterday. Let's see, Ms. Bailey, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Danielle Bailey. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Court System. Through the chair, just let me try throwing my cell phone further away. Is there still an echo?
No, Alaska Bar Association, Executive Director of the Alaska Bar Association. You said court system.
Oh. For the record, my name is Danielle Bailey. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Bar Association. I am formerly a employee of the court system. Through the chair, I would like to give an update on what the Board of Governors has discussed at their last board meeting, which was yesterday, and it continued into today. Generally, the board did decide that they would like to create a subcommittee to recommend a new change to send to the Supreme Court. However, I want to provide some context on what that process looks like. According to Bar Rule 62, the Board of Governors cannot make a change to the bar rules themselves. That actually has to go to the Supreme Court. And the process by which the Board of Governors recommends a change to the Supreme Court is that they first circulate a rule proposal to membership, they publish it in our bar reg, and then it has to come back to the Board of Governors to receive, so they can discuss any public comment that was received. Following that public comment period, it can then go, they can then choose to submit that rule proposal to the Supreme Court. So for context, I do see this as being a little different than what was happened at the last legislative audit 8 years ago. Is that the last legislative audit 8 years ago, they established an MCLE committee. That committee polled bar membership, and bar membership decided they did not want to increase CLE hours. What's been different this year, and maybe of interest to Senator Hughes since she referenced this, is the MCLE committee decided that they weren't going to poll bar membership in this process because they thought, what if they just say no? So they wanted to themselves formulate a plan that would accommodate allowing for increased CLE uses. They have presented to the board. The board have received their recommendations. They are now in the process of being in a subcommittee that was established yesterday, and they will begin that process of potentially forwarding a new rule proposal to the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you for that update from the meeting. I do see in the audit, it says the board is empowered to approve and recommend rules to the Alaska Supreme Court as well as adopt bylaws and regulations. So the number of credits would fall under a rule rather than a bylaws and regulations. Is that correct?
That is correct. The Bar Rule 65 outlines the number of continuing legal education credits that are outlined as required to bar members.
Follow up. I also noted that the audit is dated June 9th, 2020, so we're almost a year out, so you're just having the meeting to make that decision. I think I would have been better assured had this meeting taken place after the audit came out, and you would have had time to go through this process. So, and I understand you have to put together your subcommittee to make a recommendation and put it out to your members and all of that. But why was not started last summer?
Through the chair, once we received that recommendation, we had to wait till our next Board of Governor meeting, which was in October. At that meeting, the board directly decided to set up a subcommittee, or decided to set a committee by made up of the MCL committee members, the continuing legal education members, to determine if they wanted to make a recommendation to the board because they were closer to that matter at hand. That committee has met, I believe, three times between October and our most recent Board of Governor meetings. They sent a proposal to the Board of Governors, which they received at their May meeting yesterday. And then at that meeting yesterday, the Board of Governors immediately decided to set up a subcommittee so that they could look into this matter. So there have been meetings that have happened. I also saw President Hoffmeister's hand go up, so I wasn't sure if he wanted to respond as well. But thank you for allowing me the chance to clarify.
A follow-up. So how often does the board meet, and do they not have the ability in between meetings to set up a work group to work on something like this? It just seems we basically let 11 months go by before we're setting up a subcommittee to work on this.
Through the chair, the board tends to meet four times a year. Sometimes they do have to set up special meetings. As you stated, the audit came out this summer. They wanted to create an MCLE committee to look at this first, so that way people with the greatest expertise could get their eyes on this matter first and then send them a recommendation. So they were looking at it right away. They just wanted to make sure that they sent it to the proper people to send them a report, which they have now received.
And one more follow-up, and then we might hear from the gentleman who had his hands up. So we pulled up the CLE requirements by the other states from the American Bar Association. Looks like 44 other states have a lot more requirements than we have here, so I just wanted to get that on the record. And if the other gentleman wanted to comment, he seemed to have his hand up.
Mr. Hoffmeister, did you have a comment?
through the chair to Senator Hughes, Ben Hoffmeister, I'm the president of the Alaska Bar Association this year. So when I was raising my hand, specifically it was in response to what Ms. Bailey was saying. And I don't know if you remember this or not. I know you're very busy and you're going through a lot of meetings, but this is something I brought up on Wednesday when Chris Curtis from Legislative Audit was present. And we received the audit in June and then we filed our response. So the first thing to do was we filed a response to the audit. That entailed the idea that we would be working on this. And so I want to just stress that this is not something, specific to you, Senator Hughes, we haven't been shedding this particular subject. We've been working on it and we will continue to work on it. One of the things that I think it was worth mentioning is one of the reasons why we need a subcommittee to review this further is because the recommendation that we received included multiple options, which just can't be decided upon by 12 voting members of any body in the course of an hour or two of a meeting. And so that's the reason why we are having further review of this before we send this out to our membership and then to the Supreme Court. And I also want to stress something else just in regards to your comment. I understand this committee's concern about the total number of hours, but as we discussed, and I believe it was discussed at the last meeting, the twin goals and the twin basically foundations of the Bar Association are admissions and discipline. And the core of that is ethics. And I understand that you have the comparison amongst all the states, but I really do want to point out that in terms of ethics, which is, I think, the major concern that this body should have and that the bar has, we are one of the most onerous, if not the most onerous, in the country. And the reason for that is a lot of those states that you're looking at as comparators, they will have ethics requirements, perhaps 3 hours like we do, but those 3 hours will be spread out over 3 years. And so we require ethics requirements every year. And I think that's something this not only should this body take note of, but should be feel safe and aware that we are doing the right thing in terms of what we have right now. Can we do more? Sure. And as Ms. Bailey said, we will be presenting something to the Supreme Court. We're just not quite there yet because we have multiple options to consider.
Senator Hughes.
And just as follows up to that, I do appreciate the attentiveness to ethics, and that is, it's actually very commendable, and I applaud that. But as was mentioned Wednesday too, that just that people do spend a lot of their hard-earned income on legal fees, and we want to know that the profession is doing is doing the best that it can be doing and up to speed. I will note in the audit, it said that in a three-year period that the board met 18 times. So it sounds like sometimes you do meet more than four times a year. That would average out to be six times a year. I'd also note that there were nine of meetings reviewed during that time, and seven of the nine were not noticed on the state's online public notice system, and six of the nine agendas did not designate time for public comment. So that is a concern as well, and I know that you're working to remedy that, and perhaps you have, but it just gives me a little bit of pause about the maximum extension, and so I'll just leave it at that. And I wish we had a little more resolution, and I understand, you know, that there's some credits that may not be applicable to depending what type of law a certain attorney may practice. But when I see 44 states have quite a few more requirements than we have here in Alaska, just we want Alaskans to be well served. So I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just by way of comment, I guess it sounds like in response to the audit, we have a regulatory board rocketing forward with all the speed of government. But the other comment I would offer is I've discussed with a couple of attorneys I know just informally, and they would like nothing more than to see greater variety in the continuing legal education courses. I think that might overcome a lot of the objection to greater quantity, as if there was a greater spread of topics and attendant quality. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Representative Klayman, thank you for joining us in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Did you have some comments?
Well, not actually a comment at this point, but if either Ms. Bailey or Mr. Hoffmeister could actually describe the options that the Mandatory Continuing Legal Education Committee referred to the board, because it sounds like part of the reason they're not moving as swiftly is they received different options about the mandatory CLE. And if they could describe what the options were that were presented to the board yesterday, I think that might help give you a little more context for what's going on.
President Hoffmeister or Ms. Bailey?
Through the chair, I'll take first crack at this, and President Hoffmeister can join in if he so sees. One of the options was to include increased our mandatory CLE hours, and it was specifically to increase it in regards to our ethics. That committee did decide that they thought that is where the majority of the focus should be made. For context, one thing that the committee looked at was the fact that because we have some of the highest ethic hours, that might be the reason that Alaska has some of the lowest complaints per attorney throughout the entire United States. And so they were looking at that primarily to make that judgment call. They did come up with another proposal that was not to change, and then also the board, now with creating the subcommittee, has the ability to look at other options as well. So they were trying to provide a variety, and the board wanted to also be able to explore additional options if so needed.
President Hoffmeister, do you have any comments? Feel free to say no.
to the chair, no.
All right. Senator, drawing a blank here, Senator Shower.
Like you take one. I was just going to throw it out there. For the record, so my question to Mr. Chairman goes back to what we talked about, you know, just the discussion of the length of the board. I want to be crystal clear. This has nothing to do with this individual board. I don't think that they're doing anything wrong, and I think that they're clearly trying to update things from the audit. I'll just go back to the same point we discussed before, that I think 8 years is an eternity in this building in politics, and I think that is too long, because regardless of what anybody says, as Senator Keel pointed out, we move at the speed of molasses and the wheels of bureaucracy. And when we have, say if it was 4 years or five or whatever it might be, it drives things to be reviewed. It drives an audit. It drives us to take a look at things and exert that kind of look of what's happening and being involved in it. And quite honestly, let's be frank, when we're just doing our business here, we're busy. And we don't think about certain things until they come before us. So I think it's fantastic that they're looking at different education requirements. I think it is good that they're looking at the audit things and they're trying to correct them. That's the way the process should work. And so I just want to be clear when we're having this discussion, this isn't about this board in particular. I've had the same argument and the same philosophy or all the other ones. I don't think that we should go to these really long times in between where we get a little more involved and take a look at things so we're answering questions and make sure we're all being good stewards of what we're doing as government officials. So I just throw that out, Mr. Chairman, because we had the debate of whether we might try to amend it today or we can certainly, you know, if we would like to amend it later, but I think it's important to get that back on the record because it's a discussion we were going to have today. So either now or later is fine, but I wanted that back out there. But I did want the board to hear that. I want to be crystal clear. This isn't about the board in particular. All of you up on the screen has nothing to do with you. I've had the same argument on many other boards when we're looking to extend the date, so I just wanted the bill sponsor to know that as well. Thank you.
Unless there's other comment from the committee, I plan to set this aside until Monday. We have a lot of work scheduled today, and I'd rather not do any kind of conceptual amendment at this time, and we'll set a amendment deadline for probably 10 a.m. Monday morning. Okay? So at this time, Representative Klayman, did you have any further comments on this?
I just appreciate hearing the bill. I think it's interesting questions that the committee's having, and look forward to seeing what you all do between now and, I guess, 10 a.m. and then 1:30.
I'm looking forward to see what we do for the next hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I want to see what the House does over the weekend, not the Senate. So.
Senator Keel.
For whatever it's for a Senate shower, I think we're all going to celebrate Mother's Day, but we'll be on the floor on Monday.
Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I was just thank you, and we'll look to Monday as well. On the general philosophy thing, I mean, we have a statute, right? And so if we want to do general philosophy, I think 0803-020 sets that band for the auditor, and she's made a recommendation. If we want to tighten that band for all boards, that might be the place rather than one by one. Thanks.
With no other comment, I'm going to set HB 109 aside, and we're going to move on to SJR 7. Senate Joint Resolution 7 is a proposed amendment to the Constitution requiring voter approval of a new tax. The Senate Judiciary Committee previously heard this resolution on April 30th and May 3rd. Public testimony was closed on April 30th. An amendment deadline was set for May 6th at 2 p.m. My office received a total of two amendments. I will give Senator Myers a little bit more time to see if he can find Amendment 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do have both the amendments that I submitted, but I did not have them actually numbered unless we wanted to go with the simple A1 and A2 numbering that's already there, if that suffices for you.
That will suit.
All right, so we'll call A1, we'll call that Amendment 1, I suppose. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will move Amendment number 1.
I will object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this amendment is here because of a concern that Senator Hughes brought up in our last discussion of this bill. She noted that we could have a public vote on, for example, a 2% sales tax. And people go, oh, well, that's relatively reasonable. You know, 2% is pretty small. And then the following year, the legislature could take that. And because it's not establishing a new tax and just raising a tax, then they could easily bring it up and say, okay, well, next year it's going to be 10%. And while I don't imagine that it would necessarily rise that dramatically in a single year, these things do tend to rise. In North Pole, for example, we've got a 5% sales tax. When it was first enacted, it was 3%. And so what we wanted to say was that if you're going to be raising a tax, if we're trying to look to the people to say, hey, we want a little bit of your input here, then I would tend to think that it's a little bit cumbersome to go back to the people every time we want to change a tax. But to say that we're going to put a higher than usual bar on raising the base rate of a tax, I think that that's a pretty reasonable compromise in the middle there. And so that's why I wanted to put forward this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Is there any discussion? Senator Keel.
Question, Mr. Chairman, I guess, whether the sponsor of the amendment, it wasn't clear from the words to me, whether the sponsor of the amendment intends this to apply only to base rates or also to effective rates.
I The point here was to do affect the base rate. My point wasn't to say, okay, if we removed an exception, I didn't want to have to do a two-thirds vote on that, just if we were going to raise the base rate of a tax.
I'm going to follow up, Mr. Chairman, if I may. So our former colleague, Representative Guerra, had legislation to delete the gross value reduction within our oil tax structure. And that wouldn't change the rate of our oil taxes, but I think the government take would go up pretty significantly, especially from our younger fields. That would be okay. That wouldn't take this supermajority vote. Is that correct?
I would have to double check that because I'm not as familiar with oil taxes as I am as I should be in this position yet. But my first thought would be no, it would not be effective.
I think last follow-up on the language of the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we were to take an existing tax type and apply a negative adjustment to the basis, but not, again, change the base rate, that would significantly increase the take, but would not be impacted by this amendment?
I'm sorry, you said a negative change in the rate?
No, in the basis. So if we, rather than reducing the basis of the value that's taxed, we increase the basis of the value that's taxed by some legislatively determined number so that we could effectively increase the rate but not touch the rate.
Oh.
Same as if we deleted the gross value reduction.
So effectively you're talking about if we had a so, for example, let's talk property taxes. There are property tax exemptions that, you, as a resident, you can remove the first, I believe it's $20,000. if you change that from the first $20,000 down to the first $10,000 is what you're suggesting, as one example. Does that effectively come up with it?
For instance, I think that would effectively change those who are getting the tax take from those who are getting a $20,000 tax exemption, yes.
Okay. With the language that we have in here, then no, that would not take a two-thirds vote.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will withdraw my objection for discussion. Is there any other objection to the amendment? The amendment is adopted. So Amendment 1, 8.1. Regarding SGR 7 is adopted. Next up would be Amendment 2, also by Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move Amendment Number 2, that's A.2.
Senator Myers, I think we should have led with this one. I will object for discussion.
Your committee, Mr. Chair. with number two here, pretty short amendment. All we're suggesting is that if we're approving if the legislature is approving a tax that has been passed through the initiative process, all we're saying is that we still approve it through a resolution, but we don't have to do it in joint session. The resolution just goes through the normal process here. Given the issues that we have seen recently in this legislature over the last couple of years and how difficult it can occasionally be to have a joint session, I thought that perhaps the concept of having to require a joint session seemed a little bit cumbersome, and as Senator Hughes pointed out also, that if we require a joint session, then all it takes is one presiding officer to block it from happening to begin with.
And for further discussion, I do believe we have some lifelines in the room. I believe there's members of the administration present who could possibly speak to it, Director Steininger or, pardon me. Mr. Barnhill, I just want you to feel free that you're welcome to chime in on this if you like.
Through the chair,
Representative Senator Myers, this is Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. The administration doesn't have a position on Amendment A2, but the way Senator Myers described it is the way we understand it. So for the legislature to approve an initiated tax would take 21 votes in the House and 11 votes in the Senate.
Is there any discussion? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess as I think about this, a question for the sponsor, is there any way, and I should know this, and I apologize that I don't, is there any way that this resolution could be approved in joint session rather than through the standard plotting process of a bill? After this requirement for a joint session is deleted?
That's an interesting question. I would, I'd want it to be blunt. I'd want to talk to Ledge Legal about that to double check the parliamentary procedure. My first thought is that since we're deleting it and not mentioning it one way or the other, that it would still be a possibility, but it would be out of the ordinary. Joint sessions are usually done for very specific purposes and pretty rarely. So it would be a little surprising to me that we would, if we're not required to do a joint session, that we would call a joint session.
I think, unless Senator Hughes has a correction, I think that's right.
Senator Hughes.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if Mr. Milks could come on, because I'm wondering to take care of that rather than deleting by a majority vote, we would, if we just deleted in joint session, that if it would give either option. And I don't know if Mr. Milks is prepared to answer that.
Yeah, good afternoon, committee. Committee members, through the chair, or chairman, can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Senator Hughes, I'm just looking at the amended language right now. I mean, the proposed amendment has by majority vote in joint session. So I think one thing is if you remove that language, then that's established sort of the history of how this amendment has developed. So a majority vote in joint session, of course, is different than a obtaining a majority vote in each House. So I think you would not be able to go right to a majority vote in joint session because that would be contrary to the way how the amendment developed. So I'm just reading this Amendment 2 right now again. So with the proposed amendment, I guess at SJR 7, page 2, line 8, line 7 and 8 would provide that to not take effect unless the legislature by resolution approves the initiated law before the adjournment of the next regular session. To me, then the history would be where you had a proposed original draft to have a majority vote in joint session that was removed, and now you're going to a resolution that presumably, I think, as Mr. Barnhill explained, that would probably be interpreted as each House acting by majority vote.
Senator Hughes might have some clarification.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, if this amendment were to be adopted, Mr. Milks, could you either approve it in a joint session or separately? Would it give the option of both, or would you have to do it separately? We're just trying to figure out what this amendment would do. And then I thought, well, if you just took out the words in joint session, then it would leave it for either joint session or separately in each body. But we need to understand whether joint session would be an option if we pass this amendment.
Yes, Senator, through the chair, Senator, I think because the legislature acts through each house by majority vote, except there are only in a few rare circumstances where the Constitution talks about a meeting enacting by majority vote in joint session, such as with appointments, I think there would certainly be a real question about the ability to take this action in a joint session.
Senator Hughes.
Language was removed.
Yeah, and I'm sure members are already thinking that politics is at play, because you could have one body controlled, you know, one body to the right, one body to the left, et cetera. So meeting together could change the final outcome rather than them going through each body separately. So I just thought I'd put that before the members, and wondering then if the administration wanted it to be in joint session for a situation where you might have bodies coming from two different angles, and that's why you specified joint session.
I don't believe there's any more comment, is there?
Mr. Barnhill.
Oh, Mr. Barnhill, are you muted?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think just posed a question as to the administration's intent, and I'm speculating that the intent was just to, in the Constitution, when the legislature considers something constitutionally, it's usually done by joint session. So I think it was probably just an attempt to have parity in drafting with other provisions of the Constitution.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I appreciate that. And as I think back on our uniform rules, without a requirement, I don't think we could send a resolution like this to a joint session, which leads me to, I guess, a concern about the amendment that's in front of us, because it really takes away, you know, this is the section of the proposed amendment that does the most to quell the will of the voters. And this takes away an opportunity for a governor to convene us in a joint session. So the discussion earlier in our last meeting was about, you know, do you have a situation where one presiding officer or the other could single-handedly quell the will of the voters by not bringing this up? And or do you get to a position where this amendment, I think, takes us, where any given committee chair along the way could quell the will of the voters by just not letting this resolution move. If you had the joint session option, a governor could cut through that. A governor who was committed to, you know, saying the people have voted and at least the legislature should weigh in on that and not simply fail to act. So, you know, the governor has the power to convene a joint session. It's clear in the Constitution. It's not particularly difficult for a governor to do. Takes a signature on a piece of paper, whether that's appointments or, in the event this passes unamended, a resolution like this. So I think in a proposed overall constitutional amendment that is has really troubling components to put down what the Alaskans want, this gives another opportunity to do that, rather than providing a governor the opportunity to at least put people on the record if they're going to put down what the voters decide. So I think probably the wrong direction.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So two responses to that is, one, Senator Keel mentioned that we could have a committee chair block the block a resolution going forward. And that is a possibility, but we also have ways around that. We have Rule 48, and, you know, we can discharge things from committee and such. So I think that in that particular case, while there are ways to block, there are also ways around blocking it, as opposed to if a particular presiding officer on either side did not want to accept the invitation to a joint session, or didn't want to give out the invitation, depending on which side we were talking about, then it wouldn't happen. Then there wouldn't be a way around that. the way I understand parliamentary procedure as currently sits. As far as the giving the governor the ability to do it, I'm pulling up the Constitution here, double-checking. My understanding is that the governor can call a special session, but he doesn't call us into joint session. We do that ourselves. If you've got the reference that says otherwise, I'd like to see it.
Mr. Chairman, Article 3.
Senator Q.
Thank you. Article 3, Section 17. Whenever the governor considers it in the public interest, he may convene the legislature, either house, or the two houses in joint session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stand corrected.
I tend to lean towards supporting the original phrasing in the bill. And I'll probably maintain my objection on this and let it go to a vote. I just wanted to see if you had any comments on this. Did you want to maintain your amendment?
I'll go ahead and withdraw the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I withdraw my objection, and you withdraw your amendment. All right. So is there any further discussion on SJR 7? Seeing no further amendments.
Mr. Chairman, what's your intent with the bill today?
My intent is to look to the will of the committee.
Okay, I will. I want to speak, but up to you whether we do that now or at the motion.
You can speak now if you care.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I do object to SJR 7, and I don't think it ought to go any further. It's been a fascinating discussion, and it's not often that we get to really look to how our government is put together and how it ought to be. And constitutional amendment proposals are one of those rare times. This has the unusual quality of being simultaneously anti-Republican and anti-democratic. It's a singular accomplishment, really. I want to send it back to some of my politics professors in college, but they've all retired. In essence, what we have with SJR 7 is not a philosophy of government or a philosophy of how government ought to work. What we have with SJR 7 is just an attempt to tip the playing field. And make any attempt to add taxes, which nobody smiles when they pay. I don't like my tax bill. To make any attempt to add taxes more difficult. Period. Full stop. That's not a structure of government. That's not a relationship between the people and the government that represents them. It's just an attempt to cook one particular policy preference into the foundational document of our state. And so I'm going to object to moving the bill.
All right. Having noted that, Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I'll just say, because it's very rare for taxes to go down, and it's very common for them to go up over time, government doesn't produce any of its own wealth. It relies on every dollar coming from the private sector. I actually like making it a little more difficult and putting some checks and balances on it. So I'll just say that I understand what Senator Keel is saying. It is kind of unusual, but I think our state, we've seen research as far as our spending per capita, even though we do provide services in off-the-road rural communities not provided in other parts of the country, and so our expenses will never be even the average. They'll always be higher. I still have concern about that, so I'm not going to be objecting to it moving forward, although I do want to say that I feel when I stood up to run for this seat and I took the oath of office that I am willing to make those hard choices. That is what a representative republic is about. So I do have a little bit of mixed feelings myself, but I do like the checks and balances when it comes to taxes. But at the same time, I'm willing to make hard votes myself. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't said anything on this one yet, and I'll make it brief. I hear both sides. I do, and this is where you try to make that hard decision on a constitutional amendment, because cracking open that book, that document, should be taken with great gravitas because of what we may do, both unintended and intended consequences. So the thing that I'm struggling with is that while I don't want to limit the legislature's ability to do its job, which is why we're here and we are the representatives of the people, at the same time, they have an initiative process that we know is cumbersome, expensive, and very hard to do when the will of the people is not being represented by the legislature. And we have a great example of that these last 6 years, and it's called the permanent fund dividend. The people have tried and they've asked, and we just won't take it up, and we continue to. When you look at 1999 to 2019, the data that the people said protect that dividend and keep it has been identical. It actually went up slightly of the support. And it's very hard for the people to do that. So I think that's something that gives them a little bit more of a voice in the process, knowing how hard it can be for them to do and that their will can and has been overridden by the legislature when that's clearly not the will of the people, is probably a step in a reasonable direction, even if it needs to be clearly guarded and carefully vetted. And it probably won't, you know, survive this building, let's be honest. Constitutional amendments don't usually make it very well. So, but at least we're having the discussion, and I think it's good. So I support it, and I think it's a reasonable step. It just needs to be very carefully considered, as has been pointed out. Thank you. I just wanted to say something.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to the idea that we don't put policy decisions in the Constitution. I believe we do. If we look at the way that our state constitution is written, your first article is very straightforward. It's the rights of the people, as it should be. Second, articles 2 through 4 deal with the structure of our government and how things work, the balance of powers between the different branches, and that makes sense. But a good chunk of the articles after that deal specifically with policy calls, whether we're talking about taxation or managing our natural resources or education, a number of other things. The policy calls are in the Constitution, and occasionally we do have to have a constitutional amendment to make a policy call. So I don't see a problem with adding this particular policy call to the Constitution. And ultimately, the policy call is maybe the government and the legislature in particular has become a little bit too powerful, and we need to rein it in a little bit. And again, as I mentioned in our last meeting, that in a lot of ways this is about trust. And do the people trust the legislature? And this is one more way that I can see for us to give them a chance, or show them that we are worthy of their trust. We'll put it that way.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Having concluded discussions on SJR 7, I will look to the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 7, Work Order 32-GS17114/alpha, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
I'll object.
Having an objection, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
No.
Senator Schell.
Yes.
Senator Howell.
Yes.
Four yeas, one nay.
With 4 yeas and 1 nay, SJR 7 is moved from the committee. Take a brief at ease for paperwork. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is back on the record. Next up would have been SJR 6. We rescheduled that to May 10th. Next up is SJR Senate Joint Resolution 5, a proposed amendment to the constitutional spending limit by the governor. The Senate Judiciary Committee previously heard this resolution on April 30th and May 3rd. Public testimony was closed on April 30th. An amendment deadline was set for May 6th at 2 p.m. We have a total of six amendments on SJR 5. Amendment number one is by myself, Senator Holland. I move amendment number one.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman, for purposes of discussion.
Okay, amendment number one. Sorry, let me get up to speed on this. Amendment number one adds a subsection which allows the legislature to exceed the spending limit for capital products. If we find ourselves in a better financial situation in the future, the process for exceeding the spending cap is the same as issuing a general obligation bond, which is already exempted from the cap. By putting this type of spending on par with issuing debt, it avoids pushing future legislators towards issuing debt when the state has the funds to pay for capital projects. The last sentence of the new subsection is critical to ensure that approving spending above the cap doesn't reset the spending limit to a higher level. So now, does the administration wish to speak to the amendment?
For the record, Neil Steinger, Office of Management and Budget. In reviewing this amendment, one piece that we noticed that is different than the current language in the Constitution related to general obligation bonds is a reference to capital projects rather than capital improvements, as it's labeled in general obligation bonds. Otherwise, the administration doesn't have a position on this amendment. It's a policy call of the legislature how capital spending is included in the cap.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We saw this again. Like I said, this is deja vu for some of us, and I know that Senator Hughes was here. I don't remember if Senator Keel was involved in these particular discussions. We did a lot of work on this particular one. One of the things in this kind of waterfall provision or going over the cap if it was required for capital was that we put a limit on it, too, so that you wouldn't come in some year and say, you know, you had a banner year and decided to put $3 billion into it when you'd like to have some of that to go, you know, back into the fund or whatever to increase it for future years. So I think Senator Hughes, if I remember right, it was about, we had a $500 million limit, I believe, that we had put in and vetted for that waterfall. I'm curious if the amendment sponsor might be willing to entertain the idea of some limit on that. So if we go over, there is a cap that you can't just, you know, spend everything that you get, if that makes sense, I hope. Or at least discuss it, because I know this was a hotly debated topic a couple of years ago on this particular amendment.
If Director Steininger, I believe I've seen the discussions before too, is the fix on this to change the wording on the amendment slightly to go to include improvements?
Chair Holland, yes, to speak a little more to that question, the capital improvements, as included in the general obligation bond language, has a kind of stricter definition than just capital projects. Frequently, capital projects in the capital budget will include things that aren't, you know, physical improvements of, you know, fixed assets or durable assets, whereas capital improvements has a stricter definition. And capital projects tends to more refer to the lapse date of an appropriation. So if, depending upon the desire of the drafting of this amendment, if the desire was, you know, to be related to a fixed asset or a, you know, kind of a traditional capital asset, capital improvements might be language to use. And I know that Mr. Milks is on the line and, you know, can speak a little more to the legal side of that question if there is.
While he might get queued up, Senator Hughes, did you have input?
Yeah, I just want to say I'm thinking of some capital projects that I'd actually like to see, and if we went back to the word improvement, it would be a problem. For instance, I would like to see alternative energy projects out in some of the villages so they're not continuing on diesel fuel, for instance. So if we went to improvement, we wouldn't be able to use those funds for something that doesn't yet exist. It'd have to be an existing asset if we use the word improvements. Is that correct?
How just, Mr. Chairman, just to add to that question, is it something we can do both? I don't know how the language works out for technical and conforming, but can you say capital improvements or projects or something to that effect? I don't know, and I don't remember, but if he could answer that as well when he answers.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes and Senator Schauer, I think for that more, it's maybe more of a drafting question for Mr. Milks in terms of those definitions, and he can speak a little bit to those types of projects and what capital improvement kind of definitions that capital improvement has included in the past.
Mr. Milks, do you care to speak?
Thank you, Chairman. It's Bill Milks from Department of Law. Interestingly, on this, the word capital projects, when I saw the amendment, I thought, well, that is actually the language in the current appropriation limit. Capital projects is used. Now, in Article 9, Section 8 on state debt, capital improvements is used. The appropriation limits use, current one, use of that word, whereas capital projects, there hasn't really been any sort of issues about interpreting it for the reasons that have been discussed earlier, you know, before the committee, which is the appropriation limit hasn't really been particularly effective, and therefore there hasn't been really a lot of scrubbing of it. So I guess a couple other points on art capital improvements, which is the words used in Article 9, Section 8, for general obligation bonds. That is, it doesn't mean, it hasn't been considered to mean just an improvement of an existing capital asset. It's a little broader than that.
So, Mr. Milks, if, as in Senator Hughes's example, going to some sustainable resource, some sustainable power supply or something, that could actually be seen as an improvement of the power system for the village, as opposed to seen as an improvement of a diesel generating facility, correct? It's like there's a bigger picture there?
Chairman, I think so. I mean, capital usually means some kind of physical asset, but it could be a new physical asset or a improvement of a physical asset. But I guess, you know, for the committee, it's a little, probably what's most important is that what the committee wants covered here when they're talking about, right now the amendment says capital projects. That is in Article 9, Section 16, right now, the appropriation limit. And I think Director Steininger is suggests, I think, that he thinks it's a little broader term. So I'm sorry, I can't be more precise for you than that, but it's what's important when you use words like capital projects is there sort of a common, ordinary understanding that the voters saw this. What would they think is a capital project? An ordinary person, because that is what the last Supreme Court says when you use words in the Constitution, what's an ordinary person think? So a capital project, an ordinary person perhaps means some kind of hard asset. But what's also important is just what the intent of the committee is, and you could always refine the language a bit if you thought it was necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With apologies to Senators Myers and Schauer, I kind of drug the administration through a knothole backwards on this, on the geobond bill. So there's a little bit of jurisprudence and a lot of old memos, especially from attorneys general, about the difference between or about what it takes to be a capital improvement for the purposes of our general obligation bonds. And to oversimplify them radically, it's got to be, to do a geobond for it, it's got to be something durable. It probably has to be something fixed. There's a significant AG opinions that a fire truck probably doesn't count.
Senator Keel, just to confirm, are we talking about the word improvement or project at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The general obligation rules in our Constitution say capital improvements. So, and then not ordinary maintenance. Maintenance can be a capital improvement, but not ordinary preventive, the stuff you should do every year type of maintenance. That leaves a little fuzz, but we defined capital project in statute. And I can't quote that statute, but I think it has to be, it's supposed to be more than $25,000, it's supposed to be one time, but it's much, much looser. You could, basically anything you could capitalize on your taxes can be a capital project. So, you know, a software license, you're not left with anything permanent or durable, but you could pay that as a capital project. So that's my nickel version, and I'm sure Mr. Milks is going to squirm in his seat and say that no good Nick really missed the target, but generally.
I'm going to invite a member of my staff up to provide some input on this. Ed King, please come up and place yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff to Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, two comments. First, the Constitution currently uses both improvements at Article 9, Section 8, and capital projects at Article 9, Section 16. So both of those words already do exist in the Constitution. The amendment here, it appears to be trying to be consistent with the general obligation bonds. If that is the intent, then the words improvement would be more consistent. The vote of the people is necessary, though, so if the legislature wanted to provide more latitude and involve projects beyond improvements, that would also be acceptable. So that's just a policy call for you, Mr. Chairman. On the point that Senator Schauer brought up earlier, how this bill evolved over the last legislative cycle, when I testified on this bill before, we did talk about a waterfall provision. I just point out that the waterfall provision was specifically related to situations where revenues exceeded the cap, and what do you do with those revenues? This bill deals with that by putting those revenues into the CBR if money is owed to the CBR, and is silent on what to do with the money if the money is not owed to the CBR. The amendment here is not a waterfall provision as much as it is an exemption to the spending limit for capital projects or improvements consistent with issuing a general obligation bond. The only reason why this language is necessary, should the committee deem it necessary, is that without this language, there is an incentive for the legislature to issue debt to get around the cap and use its debt capacity to reduce its otherwise general funds. Using this language allows the legislature to fund those capital projects in the same way that you would fund debt without actually issuing debt. And that's the intent here, Mr. Chairman.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Ed, I know we went through this and you remember a lot of that. So a couple quick questions if I can get them right. One, and for anybody, but I think you on this one, should we put projects and improvements in the same thing to make it consistent for both, or does it matter? One. Two, understanding that, you know, not necessarily a waterfall provision, but should we have something with a limit, because we did discuss that and this may not be the appropriate place. So the third point, I guess, would be, would we need another amendment or would it be more appropriate here? Because I think that is part of the intent, was to not allow, you know, you want to do something else with some of that, not just spend every penny on it, because we needed a waterfall, so because we're behind and we want to catch up on capital improvements and projects. So kind of three things packaged together. Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's because of his history. He's got a lot of time working on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sharon, through the chair. I heard two questions. I'll address those two, and then you can bring back the third. So should both the words projects and improvements be included? I lean towards no, since it sounds like projects is encompassing improvements, and that might create confusion. I would suggest that you choose one or the other. In terms of the waterfall provision, because of the vote of the people provision here, I don't see that it's necessary for there to be a limit because it is going to the vote of the people, whereas in the conversations before, that vote of the people wasn't necessary.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Well, on a different topic, Mr. Chairman, if the committee...
Senator Myers, did you express an interest?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'm thinking about the waterfall provision portion that Senator Schauer brought up. I spoke with Mr. King earlier outside of the committee talking about this amendment, talking about, as he mentioned, the incentive that it gives without this amendment. It gives the legislature the incentive to pile on more debt to do some of the things that it may want to do. Whereas with this amendment, then it could do the same things with existing cash flow, but still require the vote of the people in order to get around the spending limit. So he does bring up a good point there. With regard to a waterfall provision, it makes me wonder, given past actions of the legislature, if we could actually end up with a possibility where they really want to spend some money, and we end up with both a provision to spend the money from regular revenue, because we got a good year, and a general obligation bond on top of it. From what I remember, the last time we did a general obligation bond was, I think it was either 2010 or 2012. And at that time, revenue for the state was doing pretty good, and yet we still saw the reason and the voters agreed with us to go into debt. So I don't think that having a waterfall provision is necessary and would do what we're discussing that it may do.
And Senator Hughes.
Okay, first just the mechanics. Before this could kick in, would the CBR have to be paid back first? Mr. King referenced.
Senator Hughes, through the chair, I actually misspoke earlier. The provision in the bill currently that is in front of us, the payback provision is actually eliminated. And so without a further amendment, there is no obligation to pay back the CBR.
Okay, and another question. Just in what Senator Myers was discussing, so something is put before the voters, and with the chance the voters may say no, could simultaneously... Oh, never mind. I don't think that would ever happen. I want to know how this would work as far as calendaring, because you're appropriating it. You know, it's May. We're appropriating it for FY22, and now we're having to put something on the ballot. How would that work? It would be general election, I'm assuming, so there's always going to be that delay. How would that work?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the way that I understand the amendment is it would mimic the general obligation bond process, which means that those appropriations wouldn't be valid until after the vote. And so, yes, you're right. It would not be, you know, immediately on July 1st that the appropriations would become valid. It would be whenever that next statewide election could be held.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Keel.
On those exact mechanics, can you walk me through the language on how it has to be a general election, can't be in a primary or special, and why, where it says that it wouldn't have to, you couldn't spend it till after the approval?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I may have misspoke on the type of election, and I think Mr. Milks could speak a lot more on, you know, the mechanics on a general obligation bond. But where I would interpret that it would not be a valid appropriation until after the election is if the appropriation is approved by a majority of the qualified voters of the state who vote on the question, that condition would be a condition on the appropriation that we could not spend against the appropriation until that condition would be met.
Mr. King, you have a comment?
No, Mr. Chairman, this is again for the record, Ed King. I do believe that general obligation bonds can be voted on in a special election. I would turn to Mr. Milks for confirmation for that.
Mr. Milks, are you tuned in?
Yes, I am. Bill Milks from the Department of Law. Yes, I would confirm what Mr. King just said. Yes, general obligation bond bills can be submitted to the voters at a general election or at a special election.
Senator Keel, do you have additional? I mean, actually, a question still along this line. I know you think. I think you had a question along a different line for this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, these mechanical things actually were the new line. So we're, Senator Hughes brought us right where I was hoping to be.
Okay.
How often we can say that? So I am intrigued, though, that the language doesn't put in place. You know, with general obligation bonds, there's a necessary step. Right. If they haven't been approved by the voters, you're not going to sell the bond to anybody. Nobody's going to buy it. So you have no cash to do the project. This doesn't say that. There is no requirement here. And one wonders what would happen if a legislature and governor got together and decided to meet a perceived need and later submit the issue to the voters for approval, I think, is the word here. So ratification after the fact is approval, right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it appears the situation you're imagining or hypothesizing is a situation where the state expends funds in advance of an appropriation being effective. Is that the administration and the legislature come together, appropriate and expend funds prior to meeting the condition of those funds as laid out in the Constitution?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that's actually a great example. We have processes by virtue of attorney general opinion where we do that today, where money is sometimes expended without an appropriation, in anticipation of an appropriation, despite I believe a statute that makes that a crime, but there's a long-standing practice and AG's opinions that have ratified it.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I believe, if I'm understanding the AG's opinion you might be referring to, would be the opinion that states that once the legislature has made an appropriation, if the governor verbally tells the OMB director that they will not veto that appropriation, that we may begin expending. Is that what you're referring to, or is there some other situation?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your leeway. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
If memory serves, the Alaska Budget Report used to rail regularly against spending and coming to the legislature for a supplemental.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, so you're simply referring to the supplemental appropriation process then, where an unanticipated expenditure has occurred and a supplemental is required in order to complete the fiscal year without, you know, running into a lack of funds.
Mr. Chairman, we do that. We ratify, in fact, negative account balances as well. And all of those things would seem to be extra constitutional. So without language here in this proposed amendment, I question why we couldn't use this provision, if it's adopted, to ask the voters to approve after the fact.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, to address one of the points you made in terms of ratifications. Ratifications are when we have expended against the anticipation of collection of primarily federal revenues and then later had the federal agency determine that expenditure to be ineligible, and so then those revenues do not appear. And so that is not an expenditure outside of an appropriation. The legislature has validly appropriated the ability to collect those revenues. We expend in advance of collection of revenues because that is how federal programs tend to work. And at sometimes, you know, those expenditures are made believing them to be eligible, and then we don't receive those revenues. So at that point, we have to come back to the legislature at a later date and say the revenue source that was appropriated to the executive branch to execute on that program was not collectible, and explain why, and then receive a general fund appropriation to backfill. That's not a situation where the administration is going out expending funds for which there is no valid appropriation. So it's characteristically different. this condition within the Constitution would set a contingency upon how an appropriation for a capital project could be executed upon. So if the administration were to go and start expending on a capital project without having met this contingency, then yes, that would be in violation of the Constitution. But you know, that's not a reason not to necessarily consider this issue. The possibility of a future appropriation or a future executive branch choosing to violate the Constitution, that's kind of a separate issue. But as this is worded, it would require that vote of the people before the executive branch could execute on that. And you know, I would have faith in future OMB directors that they would continue to, you know, apply that stringency in ensuring that contingencies are met on appropriations before expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. This question is first for Ed, and then if Mr. Milks could follow up. I'm curious, on line 7 of the amendment, it uses the word may. Is that because if one legislature would decide to put this before the voters, it might involve another legislature? Let's say the 32nd legislature puts this forward and the voters agree with it. Now it's the 33rd legislature that would do the appropriation. Is that why we've used the word may? And are we envisioning then that next legislature gets a crack at deciding whether they want to do it again?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, the word may here is just simply to provide conditionality and rather than strict guidance. And so this is nothing, we wouldn't use the legislature shall appropriate because this is an option, not a requirement. And so the appropriation, the opportunity for our legislature to appropriate above the cap would be generated by this amendment. There, once the appropriation would happen by one legislature and then it would go to a voter approval, the appropriation becomes valid at the point of the voter approval. There's no secondary legislative approval after the fact.
I would say the way it's written, I think there is, because if we say we're going to spend $500 million or whatever, we want to do it, it goes before the voters, and then it hits the 33rd legislature, this language makes it so the finance tables could decide whether or not to put it in the budget or not. It's May. So we're basically, I think we're having the 33 third legislature could basically disagree with the voters and the 32nd legislature. Am I missing something because of that word may?
Mr. Chair, may I just ask a question and with hers? I think we're talking contingent language on something we've already done. This is just contingent on approval, and if it fails, it fails. We don't spend it. If it passes, we've already obligated it, correct? So that's why I think it's off.
Senator Schauer, if I followed that correctly, I believe what you're saying is that in the same process that we currently have a capital budget, and when legislature approves a project that might have a multi-year appropriation, a future legislature can reappropriate or can choose not to continue a project. The fact that a future legislature can influence the expenditure of those appropriations doesn't negate the fact that the appropriation happened with the primary legislature. There's no second appropriation requirement for a future legislature if the voters approve.
Okay, and just for clarification, so
Senator Hughes.
So that amount would actually be, the 32nd legislature would put that amount in the budget, and it wouldn't go through unless it were approved by the voters. So the next legislature wouldn't do anything with it, basically. Okay, sorry.
Yes, and Senator Hughes, to further that point, the legislature should not simply put a number in the budget, but also identify the projects that are being approved.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Precisely this line. So then, are appropriations made with this approval subject to or available for reappropriation?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I'm going to defer that question as it's, I don't want to swim that deeply into the legality of the constitutional law. Maybe Mr. Milks is willing to address it.
Mr. Milks?
Thank you, Chairman. I mean, what's interesting about this is when we're talking about how to interpret the Constitution or constitutional law, it's like you look at how the Constitution is written and actually you're writing a proposed constitutional amendment right now. So, so if you're asking how this language reads at the moment it's reading, legislature may appropriate an additional amount for capital projects if the appropriation is approved by a majority of the qualified voters. So I would think a reasonable and practical understanding or interpretation of that is that once the legislature appropriates and the voters say yes, then that has finished that appropriation. So to turn around the legislature to reappropriate that amount of money, it's like the legislature took two to make this happen. The legislature originally appropriate and the voters approving, unlike a standard appropriation, which only the legislature is acting, the legislature could return. But these are all good questions that ultimately, when you have constitutional amendments, you look at what the language says, and you look at what all the committee discussion was, and you ultimately look at, try to understand what the voters were informed by. So at this snapshot in time, what I can offer is what I just offered.
Thank you for those words, Mr. Milks. And with that, I have just four words, a brief at ease. Good afternoon, Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is back on the record. Apparently we'd gotten further along that discussion than I had realized. Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Amendment number one is adopted. Okay. Now we'll move on to amendment number two. Amendment number two is also by myself, Senator Holland. I move amendment number two.
And Mr. Chairman, I will object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, this amendment, I spoke on this a little bit at the last meeting. It attempts to clarify potential ambiguity and exclusions to the spending limit. For example, a litigant could argue that the over $1 billion appropriation of the public education fund is exempt from the spending limit. Then, because the expenditures from that fund do not require further appropriation, this litigant could also argue that the grants provided to school districts are also excluded or also exempt from the cap. In this way, a future legislature could theoretically avoid the spending limit through a series of transfers that are not subject to further legislative action. This amendment makes clear that only transfers between accounts that maintain legislative control are exempt, just like the transfer between your checking and savings account isn't part of your household budget. It also allows transfers to the two accounts that should not be under the cap to be excluded, appropriations of the permanent fund and payments to reduce our unfunded pension obligation. Are there any comments on this amendment? Seeing none.
Would your staff be able to just explain a little bit more?
Senator Hughes. And also, or the or Director Steininger, but Mr. King, would you please take back at the, get back at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Staff Center, Holland. Mr. Chairman, you described the amendment very well. Just like in SJR 6 of the previous legislative cycle, the words subject to further appropriation would be included with this amendment. This is just to ensure that accounts where a further legislative action is necessary isn't considered part of the appropriation process and doesn't contribute to the cap, the expenditure of up to the cap. But expenditures or appropriations to funds that are not subject to further appropriation, like the Public Education Fund, the Abandoned Vessel, Derelict Vessel Fund, the Oil Gas Tax Credit Fund, and this series of other funds that are not subject to further appropriation, those do remove themselves from legislative action once those are appropriated, and therefore they should be considered appropriations when the transfer is made. This is making it clear we're talking about accounts, not just savings accounts, but any account that is subject to further appropriation is just as simply a transfer between accounts. The legislature still maintains control. Those transfers shouldn't contribute to the cap.
Director Steininger, do you wish to speak to the amendment?
Yes, again, for the record, Neil Steininger, Office of Management and Budget. Yes, this amendment does provide necessary, additional clarity on this issue and further defines state savings account, which just provides additional clarity to this amendment.
Senator Keel.
How then, thank you, Mr. Chairman, how then would we treat the legislature deciding, a future legislature deciding to put funds in a, dollars in a fund that was not otherwise require appropriation to some alternate use? We say, this derelict vessel thing, forget it. This is not important to us. We have a better place to use the money.
Senator Keel, through the chair, actually, I'll try to answer the question first, but you're going to be better at answering this one. But the requirement that when the appropriation is made to that fund, the use of those funds, the expenditure from that account, are limited by the statute. If that fund were to be repealed, my intuition is that those funds would lapse back to the general fund.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would agree with statements of Mr. King. If you were to have a fund, say the derelict vessel fund, and depopulate that fund effectively, that would become effectively general fund revenue. So wherever you used it elsewhere would then be an expenditure subject to the cap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with that characterization. The question is, in terms of counting for the cap, those dollars count twice, right? They counted when they went in, and they counted again when they went out. Why? We didn't spend them twice.
Yes, Senator Keel, unless there was a situation where the appropriation happened and then the account was depopulated and then the money was then again appropriated within the same year, that would be true. In most situations, I don't believe that situation would manifest. The expenditure would apply to the cap in the year they were originally appropriated to the fund, and then they would again count towards the cap in a future year when they've returned to the general fund and expended again. That would be correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate understanding the intent. I have some concern about the opportunity cost that we lose out. If in a situation where the state of Alaska is up against the cap, and those funds competed, as the Constitution envisions, against all other uses of the funds, some other public need was not met, and then again when a decision throw those out like it made, even in a subsequent fiscal year. If they count again toward the cap, that's twice they've displaced some other public need, right?
Senator Keel, through the chair, you also have a revenue component there. So you have an expenditure and then a revenue and then another expenditure. And so the revenue component and the expenditure component cancel. So it ends up being one expenditure, even though it is counted twice. It's also counted as revenue twice.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For accounting purposes, but it's not a new state revenue. Doesn't come out of, as Senator Hughes would say, the private sector's hands a second time.
Is there any further discussion? One final question from Director Steininger. How does the administration stand on this amendment? Do you have any input on it?
Chair Holland, we see the expanded definition and clarification as positive. The exemption of the unfunded liability of the retirement system is a policy call of the legislature.
With no further discussion, Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further objection? Objection by Senator Keel.
I've spoken to it.
I'm sorry, say again?
I think I've said my piece.
Okay. Madam Secretary, call the roll.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Schauer.
Yes.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Holland.
Yes.
4 yeas, 1 nay.
With 4 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 2 is adopted. We move on to amendment number 3. Amendment number 3 is also by Senator Holland. I move amendment number 3.
I object, Mr. Chairman, for purpose of the discussion.
Okay, amendment number 3 restores the exemption for corporate receipts. Public corporations are run like private business with fees for service funding the operation costs of the corporation. Restoring the existing language in the Constitution allows those self-funded operations to function outside of the limitation of government growth. Does the administration wish to speak to the amendment?
Chair Holland, upon further review of the drafting of removing this language in our draft, further review of that, I think we're supportive of this amendment. I think it adds, there were unintended consequences in the removal of this from the exemptions in our draft of the constitutional spending limit.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? How could I guess? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I try to keep you on your toes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we talk about revenues of these corporations, the corporations have to be ones that issue revenue bonds. But are appropriations to these public corporations revenues of the corporation?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, an appropriation of unrestricted general fund to one of these corporations, my understanding and read of this would be that that appropriation to capitalize a new corporation would be subject to the cap. It would be, the operational costs funded through the activities of one of these corporations, through their revenues, through their activities, that would not be subject to the cap. So additional infusion of unrestricted general fund would be subject to the cap. That's a state revenue, not a revenue of that corporation.
Mr. King, did you have some input?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just to answer the question directly, funds by the state other than fees for service contractual obligations that are revenues of the corporation are not considered revenues of the corporation. It's the revenues of the corporation. These corporate receipts are revenues that are generated by the corporation and the operations of their business, and not any subsidy that the government might give them from the general fund.
Senator Keel.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like that answer forecloses our ability to put a bunch of our road maintenance into the railroad's hands, for instance. What we'd have to do then is create new toll road corporation of the state of Alaska to directly levy fees on Alaskans, and then proceed with that public corporation model for any state function we wanted to shift off the books. But that would be effective, right?
Senator Keel, through the chair, we just because we had this conversation before, I think I can answer that question. The fear being that you can shift money outside of that's currently in the operating budget outside of the cap by creating a corporation. The revenues of the corporation are fees for service of the corporation, and so you could circumvent this cap by creating a corporation, as you said, with like a public infrastructure, like a toll road or a bridge or something like that. Create a corporation that generates revenues. However, that function of that corporation would, in effect, pay for itself, in that it's generating revenues to pay for its operations. The Kinnick Arm Bridge for Kabato, for example, right? That could be a public corporation that generates revenues and could exist outside the cap by this language. That is correct. The The idea here, though, is that corporations generate revenues based on the services that they're provided and are not funded by taxpayer dollars. And so if the intent of the spending limit is to limit government growth and restrict the generation of taxes for government growth, the existence of corporations would be different or should be viewed differently than a different type of program, government program.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. I agree that they should be viewed differently. They are radically less accountable. They have no obligation to be fair. I think back to growing up in Anchorage when a public corporation, or maybe it wasn't strictly a corporation, but it could easily have been, was created to handle the downtown parking situation. They provided that otherwise public service with fees on Alaskans. And I don't know if anybody recalls the parking ferries and the subsequent voter revolts before finally the Anchorage Assembly decided they had to get their arms around this monster. But unelected, unaccountable entities created to provide what was otherwise a public service on their own terms, on their own rules, and answerable to basically nobody are a pretty rotten thing for us to incentivize in the Constitution.
Thank you, Senator Q. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to provide a little bit of a counterpoint, if we don't pass this amendment, if either Mr. King or Mr. Steiniger could correct me if I'm wrong here, but if we don't pass this amendment, though, then all of a sudden that ticket that we just sold to the tourists to the Alaska Railroad this year, assuming we have any tourists in the Alaska Railroad this year, then all of a sudden that money would end up being subject to this cap and would be considered state revenue. Whereas if we pass this amendment, then that is no longer subject to the cap and the railroad can just spend that money to further its operations per usual.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Hughes.
And I was thinking that along the lines of our ferry system too, because there's looking at some possible restructuring with that, and we want the ferry system to be able to provide the service, and there may be some creative things that come down the road which may increase those passengers and revenues from that, and I would see that as a good thing to help sustain the ferry system. So. I'll just point that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Hughes. That's got great potential. And some legislative hook and connection to that to keep it under control is important. But if we've got to have a revenue bonding, self-funding corporation, we lose that.
Thank you, Senator Q. With no further discussion, Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further objection? Senator Keel objects. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Schauer.
Yes.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator Holland.
Yes.
4 yeas, 1 nay.
With 4 yeas and 1 nay, Amendment number 3 is adopted. Moving on to Amendment number 4. Amendment number 4 is by Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment 4.
I will object for discussion. Would you explain the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the point of Amendment 4 here is, to some extent, it brings us back to a little bit more of how things work currently. It would lead. So you've got four sections in Section 17 there in Article 9, and A, B, C, D, A is your revenue limit, and that is the part that we're leaving as it is written in the joint resolution before us. B then is the conditions of how you can spend out of the constitutional budget reserve with a majority vote. And the fact of the matter is that the way that the language is currently structured in there, you effectively have never been able to spend out of the constitutional budget reserve with a majority vote, and that would not change unless we radically altered how we operate our legislature right now with our designated general funds. So we're going to remove that section. Then there is C and D. which has to do with how you spend out of the C is how you spend out of the constitutional budget reserve currently with a three-quarter vote for anything you feel like, and D is then the repayment provision. As the constitution, as the joint resolution before us currently stands, it removes C and D. And what I'm proposing is that we actually remove B because ultimately it's superfluous, and we restore C and D so that we are still required to pay back the constitutional budget reserve, and we still are able to either stop that payback with a three-quarter vote or pull money out with a three-quarter vote.
Director Steininger, does the administration wish to speak to the amendment?
Chair Holland, the administration is neutral on this amendment. Ultimately, that is a policy decision of the legislature whether or not to eliminate the repayment provisions and the three-quarter vote from the CBR.
Thank you, Director Steininger. Is there any other discussion from the committee? Senator Hughes.
Just a clarification, if I could, from the maker of the amendment. So it basically maintains the way it is right now. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
With no further discussion, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? With no objection, amendment number 4 is adopted. On to amendment number 5 by Senator Keel. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment 5, and I'm going to find my place.
I've always admired that you're the one up here with the electronics, and we're the one here drowning in paperwork. So don't let me down. But I will object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found my place. Mr. Chairman, we had a brief discussion in the earlier hearing on this about the impact of removing the word directly from Article 17, Article 9, Section 17A. Which is the proposal here. And I shared with the committee a memo from Legislative Legal Services and had a conversation with the OMB director, who provided a 10-page letter from the Department of Law, which unfortunately I think we just got right before committee. And so, Mr. Chairman, if I haven't had the chance to read this yet, but I'll be happy to. The point of this amendment is, not to put too fine a point on it, to make sure that the amounts in dispute, when we have some kind of tariff argument, some kind of tax fight that lingers on past fiscal years, goes into the CBR. And goes into the CBR, my intention would be on the same terms it did for decades prior to, and I want to be fair, prior to the, whatever change this letter I haven't read yet describes. It's not, I think, really it's not a change that affects current year cash we have to work with. These are tariff disputes and tax disputes and audit disputes that come in years after the fiscal year when, if everything had run smoothly and no tariffs had been changed, et cetera, they would have flowed to the Treasury. And that's why the CBR provision was written this way, right? Those windfalls after the fact ought to go in the savings account. And I think that's a good idea, especially with Senator Myers' amendment we just adopted, is that we have that savings account with the difficult lock on it. That's the intent behind amendment number 5. How would you like to proceed by not having read this yet?
There is still another committee beyond this, finance, and I would suggest you withdraw the amendment and have a chance to review that and possibly bring it back up in finance.
I wasn't thinking in terms of withdrawing, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking in terms of proceeding now or proceeding later after we've all had a chance to read the.
May I ask, who is the letter or memo from?
The one I circulated is from Legislative Legal Services. This is an Attorney General's memo, or letter, rather, dated 2019, that we got on our desk today.
Oh, and do you think Mr. Milks would be familiar with it so he could provide the information? I don't know if the administration is prepared to do that.
But Mr. Milks, are you tuned in?
Yes, Chairman, I'm tuned.
I believe there's a document, April 11th, 2019. Is that the same document you have, Senator Keel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And this is regarding Amendment Number 5 and deleting the word directly. And there's a multi-page document that we're curious as to how that would impact the amendment. Are you familiar with the document in question?
Yes, Chairman. I'm familiar with it. I'll try to be brief in explaining. So the purpose of having the language in the amendment inserting directly was for the point of to stop having some disagreements between, I'd say, the Department of Law and the legislative legal. Well, I don't think legislative legal has taken a totally firm position on it, but what it involves is right now under the Constitutional Budget Reserve Amendment, that the CBR, we'll call it the CBR, is an exception to the Constitution's rule prohibiting dedicating revenues. And when the voters approved the CBR amendment, they approved a certain revenue stream that could go into the CBR and not be in the general fund. And that was an exception. There's only one other exception to the prohibition against dedicated revenues in our Constitution, which is the permanent fund amendment. So the Department of Law, through both Attorney General Lindemuth under Governor Walker and Attorney General Clarkson under Governor Dunleavy, have looked at this on the issue of, under the CBR, when there is litigation over royalty amounts or oil and gas taxes, those dollars are supposed to be placed in the CBR. There are other kinds of legal disputes involving tariffs, how much people pay for the movement of oil along the pipeline. That's tariff litigation. When tariff litigation is ultimately resolved, it could result in the producers having to pay more taxes to the state. So the question was whether or not resolution of tariff litigation, does that money belong in the CBR or does it belong in the general? And Attorney General Lindemuth and then Attorney General Clarkson in the 10-page document you have in front of you addressed this issue with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in April 2019 and set out why the Department of Law believes that the money belongs in the general fund, which was basically a sort of lengthy legal analysis that said if we look at the Alaska Supreme Court decision in Willikowski versus State, we can see that the Alaska Supreme Court has said the prohibition against dedicating revenues is intended to be broadly applied and exceptions are narrow. So therefore, in our legal analysis, to say that tariff-related money should be in the CBR when the word tariff isn't in the CBR article at all is too expansive. And so in our view, it belonged in the general fund. And interesting, if you read the letter, you can see in Department of Law's attorneys all the way back to the 1990s, Attorney General Petello had reported that tariff-related monies belong in the general fund. Nonetheless, over a period of time, it appears that the money was going into the CBR fund. Then in 2017, this was reviewed again by Attorney General Lindemuth under the prior governor, and then in 2019 in this letter, and it's Department of Law's view that it belongs in the general fund. Nonetheless, legislative legal, through the memorandum that you have, has identified the fact that that's not fully resolved. There's an alternative way to look at the law that would say it belongs in the TARIC-related money, belongs in the CBR fund. And therefore, as I understand, and Senator Keel obviously speaks for himself, but as I understand the point of this, and I'm sorry if I'm losing people, but the current proposed amendment seeks to insert the word directly into the CBR fund provision in order to remove any ambiguity about what we think belongs in the CBR fund and what belongs in the general fund. And I believe the legislative legal memorandum is saying, yes, if you put in the word directly, you're going to basically remove any doubt. Right now, there's some doubt. And the committee has that memo that Senator Keel referred to, or Senator Keel has it. It's an April 11, 2019 letter to Legislative Budget and Audit Committee co-chairs, Senator Giesel and Representative Tuck, and it lays out all of that. So ultimately, all that was sought with this with the amendment language on page 2, line 26, inserting directly, was an effort to move on from a back and forth questioning between Department of Law has a position and it's crossed administrations now on, but we see it, but obviously others have raised a question as to what, you know, how, whether or not that's a correct, is the best reading. So this was just an effort to try to move beyond that.
Thank you, Mr. Moon. Director Steininger, does the administration wish to speak to amendment number 5?
Chair Holland, we do oppose amendment number 5. As I think Mr. Milks illustrated, there is a necessity to add clarification and remove ambiguity from the current constitutional language.
Thank you, Director. Where are we at on this? I believe I will, is discussion or?
Mr. Chairman, if there's an opportunity to bring it back, I will redraft this to bring clarity. I can tell you that the clarity would not be to remove or to add the word directly. The clarity would be to make clear that the CBR, which as I understand it was created after Alaskans won giant TAPS tariff lawsuits, is funded with the results of tax money that comes in after tariff settlements too.
I will withdraw my objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'll withdraw this amendment for revision and rework.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Amendment number 5 by Senator Keel is withdrawn at this time. Good news is amendment number 6 will not be offered. There was a discussion of amendment number 6. It got to be a little complicated, and we didn't think we're even getting to the solution at hand, so amendment number 6 will not be offered. We'll move on to amendment number 7 by Senator Holland. I move amendment number 7.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman, for purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. So amendment number 7 is, I think, a much simplified version of amendment number 6, where it attempts to clarify the allowable increase in the spending limit from year to year. In the version before the committee, the limit is calculated by averaging the previous 3 years' budgets, which are typically increasing for inflation. It then allows the budget to grow by the cumulative rate of inflation over the previous 3 years. This approach ends up allowing the budget to grow by more than inflation from year to year. This amendment reduces the cumulative inflation adjustment to 2 years, limiting growth to a number closer to the rate of inflation. So this amendment just deletes the word 3 and inserts the word 2.
Brief at ease.
Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is back on the record. Are there any questions? I'll go to Director Steininger. Does the administration wish to speak to Amendment Number 7?
Chair Holland, we have no position on Amendment Number 7.
Thank you, Director Steininger. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, if Amendment 7 passes, it looks like we're adjusting 3 years spend with 2 years inflation. Does that, am I correct in understanding that leads to a reduction in real dollar spend over time?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, not necessarily. We're taking a base of 3 year average of prior year appropriations, and then we're applying an inflationary factor on that. This clarifies 2 versus 3 years of inflationary pressure, and just simply changes that time period that you look at inflation. I don't believe, we haven't had a chance to model this out, having just done this today to compare to our models. And maybe I could let the staff to Chair Holland talk about this if he has. But I don't believe that would be the case.
Mr. King, care to take the table and provide some insight on Amendment Number 7?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Ed King, staff to Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, this is just a mathematical exercise, really, because if we strip off all of the volatility and just assume that the rate of budget growth is the rate of inflation, the three-year average rate of inflation will be equal to the three-year average budget will be equal to the budget 2 years prior to the budget that you're talking about. Just that's mathematically what's going to happen. Because you're taking the average of 3 years, the average of those 3 years is going to be the budget that was 2 years ago. Adding 1 year of inflation gets you back to where you are in the current year. Adding a second year gives you the inflation adjustment for the future year that you're budgeting. A third year gives you actually a kicker so that you're allowable growth is beyond the rate of inflation.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but didn't that set as its initial case that your previous 3 years matched inflation? WIFS would prevent that.
Senator Keel, through the chair, can you restate the question?
If I understood your statement correctly, you assumed as your base case for your mathematical exercise that your three years used in the calculation here, real dollar or the budget nominal dollar budgets reflected the actual cost of government, right? So they reflected the inflation factor that so you're nodding yes. That assumption becomes invalid once you apply this factor, because you can only use 2 years of inflation, so your base case of 3 years that reflected inflation can't exist.
Senator Keel, through the chair, the mathematically that's not accurate. Because of the every time that you use this for the next previous year, you're getting the previous budget plus inflation. And so if you stay at the limit, you're always going to be growing at inflation with 2 years of cumulative inflation.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder, as Director Steininger asked, do we have modeling that would demonstrate the dynamic here?
Mr. Chairman, this is a simple mathematical exercise. It's a mathematical model and not a computer model that's necessary.
Is there, Senator Hughes?
Well, I would just ask, does Neil, do you agree with what Mr. King has stated as far as the mathematics here? Because it's a little bit beyond me, I'm just saying.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I know that Mr. King and my staff have discussed the math behind this and agree on the math. We haven't had a chance to apply it to the models we did for our presentation earlier, simply because of time. But the math, as Mr. King has described, is accurate.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, the last time we had the bill up, I expressed concern that, as introduced, it leads us in any situation where we have any kind of prosperity, any kind of population growth, in a situation where the country's doing at least okay. You've got population growth, you've got inflation, and you can only adjust for one of them. for this to reduce that adjustment, we were already in a situation where you had to cut, in real terms, government spending almost every year forever. This, I think, brings us pretty close to you have to cut real government spending every year forever. That's a problem.
What I will do...
Mr. Chairman, can I just make one comment to that? And not as a not adversarial to it, but just interesting from the data perspective. It could, and it may. However, you could look at the last years of data. We have had a net outflow in the state for 5 or 6 years running now of population, and our growth of government continues to go up. So you can see this in multiple ways. So it can happen in the reverse of that as well, where we're continuing spending with no pressure to keep it low while our population is actually leaving the state. And we are, like I said, net outflow for five or six years now. It could be verified. But anyways, thank you. I just wanted that as something to consider as well on both sides.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I'd like to hear Mr. King and Mr. Steininger's response to what Senator Keel said, that this puts us in a situation where we'd be having to cut each year. Is that, do you agree with that statement?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, that on a nominal basis, that's definitely not true. The inflation adjustment is allowed, so the government spending would be increasing at the rate of inflation. Whether that rate of inflation is commensurate with what the public needs is a different question, and there is no, under this proposal, there is no adjustment for population. So in the event that the population were increasing, then the real per capita spending would be reduced year by year. That would be accurate. But no, the real spending in total dollars would not be reduced.
Thank you, Mr.
Director Steininger.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'll just say that the math, as Mr. King has laid it out, is accurate.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I used an economist term, and I apparently used it wrong. So real dollar, if the math works as described, it was the wrong term to use. But in terms of our ability to meet Alaskans' needs, to adjust for population and inflation, this doesn't do anything to require cuts when population shrinks. Nobody's tried that, except for getting the votes, which brings us back to the main bill. I'll stay on the amendment, right? This leaves us lagging in any kind of growth scenario, and it leaves us lagging durably. I mean, it's constitutional, so functionally permanently.
I do have confidence in the math, but so I will. I do not plan on withdrawing this amendment, but we will discuss with finance beyond this and have them review this specific part of the bill. So is there any further discussion? Senator Hughes.
I'll just say that the original spending limit in the Constitution allowed for both population and inflation, and it just rose too high, and I'm not a mathematician, so I feel comfortable just going with one as opposed to both simultaneously.
And of course, Senator Keel, I'm assuming that this were to pass. I do not know that it will. Is there any further discussion? Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I don't want to be chairman of this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remove my objection. Thank you.
I'll object.
We have an objection from Senator Keel. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Yes.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Holland.
Yes.
4 yeas, 1 nay.
With 4 yeas and 1 nay, the motion is adopted. Amendment number 7 to SCR 5 is adopted. Seeing no further amendments, are there any further amendments to SCR 5? Seeing none, is there any further debate?
Chairman, I can bring your revised Amendment 5 as soon as I can get it from legal.
Can we go at ease for a moment, Mr. Chairman? Just for a moment.
Brief at ease. The Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record. Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair. I thought we already did that and accepted them all. Yeah, that's what I'm asking. I think we already accepted them all. So we're good, right?
I believe we're good.
Okay. I moved it without even checking. You just kind of, like a dog, I was trained. Sorry.
Is there further debate on SJR 5? With no further debate, what is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for the Senate Joint Resolution 5, Work Order 32-GS16644/alpha as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
I object.
With an objection from
speak to my objection, Mr.
Senator Keel, he'll speak to his objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not at all clear to me why this amendment is on such a rocket sled in this committee, and it's always disappointing when we can't have the depth of meaningful conversation that we ought to have when we're talking about changing Alaska's foundational document. That's a level let's just say haste makes waste, and certainly sloppy constitution writing is not in Alaskans' best interest. So, we got this bill in this committee quite some time ago, and then I think we've it looks like we're on a sub 2 week pace to shoot it out of here. That's disturbing. It hasn't given the administration time to get us answers to all our questions in advance, and I appreciate their effort to get information on some of our questions that just arrived today. It's a shame that we don't have the time as a Judiciary Committee to process some of these legal items and questions and have an informed conversation and debate about all of them. It's always a shame when a committee takes up only a piece of what is at issue, especially with something as serious as a constitutional amendment. But all that said, we have a motion, and I'll speak to this proposal, which is to try and put artificial caps on what Alaskans can ask of their government. It's an attempt to write into our foundational document limits that will ensure Alaska's government has an extraordinarily difficult time when times get good again. And right now they're tough, right? Revenue's down, inflation's negative, population on the whole is leaving the state, and we're in a tight budget spot. We've been in tight budget spots before, and Alaskans have sent legislators who have reduced the budget. And we talked about that with some of the administration slides that started at the bottom of a major budget cutting cycle. And we all have seen that before. Sometimes you play with the y-axis, in this case the x-axis. But the simple fact is the Constitution we have lets Alaskans set the priorities in a Republican, small r, form of government. They send legislators who have in the past cut the budget, who have in the past increased the budget. This proposal, though, attempts to ratchet down straps on future Alaskans, just in case they might want something else out of their government. And it does it in ways that I think risk really irresponsible constraints on Alaskans' ability to meet their own needs through their state government. So there's no question the old spending limit didn't work, and I appreciate the attempt to make certain changes instead of a base year, moving to an average. Things like that are interesting academic exercises. But when it boils right down to it, you either trust Alaskans to elect legislators who will do the job Alaskans elect them to do, or I suppose You try and create a situation where no matter what Alaskans need, no matter what Alaskans choose at the ballot box, the answer is no.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Regarding the documents under question, I believe I heard from experts in the field, and I'm willing to trust their interpretation. They seem to be very well versed on the documents at hand. Senator Hughes.
I just want to make a point about the process, just for those that might be listening. We have had this piece of legislation in our committee for 2.5 months, so things could have been, even concerns could have been, conversations with the administration, led legal, could have been started some time ago. I also want to say, as someone who's been in the majority and in the minority, there have been times where I've had to withdraw amendments at the last like this and allowed a bill to go out and then worked with the next committee on the issue. And so that is a pretty normal process. Yes, it'd be nice to be able to do it, you know, here and now, but it is not unusual for that process to take place that way. And we have the ability to start our questions and our research before the bill is actually scheduled at the table. So I just want to mention that to those that might be listening. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion on the objection? Seeing none, Madam Secretary, call the roll.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Schaller.
Yes.
Senator Holland.
Yes. 4 yeas, 1 nay. With 4 yeas and 1 nay, Senate Joint Resolution 5, version alpha, as amended, has moved from Senate Judiciary Committee. At this time, I appreciate everyone's patience. We're at 3:45. Our final item on today's agenda is Senate Bill 39. Related to election integrity. This is the first hearing of SB 39 in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Schauer, if you please take the table, and do you or your staff care to introduce the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'll do, just based on time, and it's up to you, and I appreciate everybody's patience waiting and give me a chance to at least get the intro out of the way, and we can do what you need to tomorrow, however you want to play it. The briefing itself, the PowerPoint, the sectional analysis is obviously it's significant. The PowerPoint's much smaller. We did that on purpose just to try to skinny that down for the debate. So off I go. Senator Schauer from District E, representing the folks, the good folks back home in the Mat-Su. Sponsor statement for Senate Bill 39. Mr. Chairman, ballot custody, tampering, voter registration, mail, et cetera, and a lot more. So if you're ready, I'll begin.
One interruption. We will be signing the paperwork, but we're going to wait till the meeting adjourns. If a senator does have to leave before then, please let us know. We'll get the paperwork to you before you leave.
Okay. I can be relatively quick here, Mr. Chair, and a couple folks have heard this already. So just moving on with it. Senate Bill 39, and I'm going to read in a little bit of so there's 2 pages worth of it. I'm going to skip through some of it, so I don't want to cheat everybody, but I don't want to just read like a drone. Senate Bill 39 updates Alaska's decades-old election statutes with attempts to strengthen voter access and improving the integrity so Alaskans may regain confidence in our election system. We sometimes disagree with election results, actually we probably always do, on whichever side of the aisle you're on, but rarely in our history have we ever refused to accept them. This is a troubling trend which has emerged where entire segments of our nation not only disagree with the election results, but they don't accept them or refuse to acknowledge them as legitimate. This happened in 2016, it happened again in 2020, and whether these concerns are real or perceived is irrelevant. We must find a way to restore everybody's faith across the political spectrum in our election system, as is a cornerstone to our constitutional republic. And of note, we started this effort 3 years ago, first filing 2 years ago, the first version of this bill. I think there's some people think that we're trying to go over the 2020 election, Mr. Chair, and that's not the case, and I can prove that by the fact we've been working on this for years. Ironically, when the left side of the political spectrum is very upset about the election results from 2016. So we've been working since 2018 on this. Problematic areas we identified, at least some of them through the process, have created integrity concerns, a lot of irreconcilable errors, and a lot of potential for error, which have limited citizens from qualifying their ballots when the Division of Elections questioned or rejected them. We currently work in a system of rejecting ballots as opposed to accepting them, or some would know the term ballot curing. Alaska's current election model is built on that foundation of disqualification and rejection of ballots. One of the significant aspects of Senate Bill 39 is to shift toward greater voter inclusion with the qualification of ballots. Voters should know when their ballots are questioned or rejected and be informed of it immediately. It's a two-part process, which includes notifying and then giving them a reasonable opportunity to correct their ballot if there's deficiencies or some other thing that would cause that ballot to be rejected. Right now, they don't even know. The ballot's essentially done and it doesn't count. We can do better than that, and we should. Carrying ballots is an essential component of SB 39. Improvements to voter access required additional extensive work on our part to the existing statutes, which are very old when you look at them. Before the 2020 elections, we only had two states that had clear regulations and policies for vote-by-mail procedures. A new measure of inclusion is amending the current statute to accept additional types of qualifying identification, such as tribal and military identification. Alaska is a diverse state. Our indigenous first Alaskans are an essential segment with unique needs not experienced in the urban or even in a lot of cases in the lower 48 environment. Our goal is to include additional provisions for increased tribal participation and for more opportunities for communities to take a greater role in their local voting systems, just as some larger communities already practice across Alaska. There are a number of what I would call flat-out lies and myths about this bill that have been propagated by a number of individuals, groups, and even sometimes the media repeating it, Mr. Chairman. So one of the goals here will be to dispel those myths so that we get it right. And the first version of the bill is very different from the current version of the bill. And that's one more thing that gets really hard to undo something. Once people start repeating the lie often enough, it gets very difficult. People believe it is the truth. Even today, I'm answering emails from people that are completely 3 months old and no longer apply. And I think it's important for the committee to also understand that I'm working very closely with a representative from the House that has another version of the bill that's different, that's very different. They're almost polar opposites, and we're working very closely together to try to find an area where we might be able to move forward and take a step or two steps or three steps on areas that both the left and the right side of the aisle can agree upon. And not everybody's going to get everything they want. That's the reality. We're going to find that we may have to give up a few things we already have. We're asking them to give up a few things, but let's find areas, and I'm going to talk about those three key ones here in a moment. Consistency and standardization of protocols, that's an overarching objective, and communities that already practice vote by mail are enhanced by improved security and authentication. We have absentee voting improvements by expanding option for voters where they may request to be on an automatic absentee ballot list. Alaskans should be able to vote in a manner which suits them and feel confident their vote is secure and counted. We're not changing anything, and I want to be clear on that too. That's one of the things that, oh, we can't vote local, or you can't automatically register. No, all that's there. Everything we currently have is in this bill that we currently do. So if you want to vote a certain way, nothing changes. And this bill doesn't require that either because, one, we know that not everybody can vote in a way that we would change it, because based on if they're in the bush, they don't have good aspect, good connectivity, Wi-Fi, et cetera, maybe not great access to mail. You name what the issue may be, it's very diverse. So we allow all of those options as we had before. So nobody has to do any of these things. We also know we can't just snap our fingers overnight and change the system. It may take years to implement some of these things. And I give a perfect example, even though I left my phone up on the dais with you. The issue is, for years, we had paper tickets for airlines, right? And everybody's like, oh, I don't want to go to this fancy phone thing. It's scary. How does that work? Well, you look at it today. Everybody is using, you know, their phone to put their ticket on, you know, when they go through security, et cetera, multi-factor authentication. Some other things have allowed us to get there. It takes time for people to get comfortable with something that's new and perhaps better, more efficient, more secure. That's where we're headed. Another major area of SB 39 improves is voter registration roll accuracy. Alaska checks only a few databases against the eligible voter list. SB 39 enables the state to clean up the voter rolls more often and cross-reference a broader segment of other available databases. It requires third-party supervised biannual audits of our voter rolls. Municipalities such as Anchorage use state data for their vote-by-mail system. It's evident that if our data is bad, so is theirs. I can give many examples of that as we go through this over the next days, weeks, whatever it might happen to be. Even got some of that data today. I could talk about it at a later time. So there are thousands more people on our voter rolls than are eligible to vote in Alaska. If we get a chance to go through the slides today or tomorrow, we can show some of the latest data on that. For example, the Division of Elections checks our voter data with 31 other states in the ERIC system. There's 19 other states we're not checking. Fascinating how many people are in those 19 other states we're not cross-checking. Over 135 million people. That's what we're missing with the list. We don't know. So it's much more than people say when they say there's nothing to see here. Data is also not checked with a number of other national and local sources, which could improve our accuracy. So what we're doing is, do we want the 60% solution or do we want the 100% solution? I think Alaskans deserve better. So one of the things the bill does is it brings us up to telling them that they need to use some of these other databases within cost constraints and where we go to cross-check our system more often to make sure we get rid of some of these excess voters that should not be on our voter rolls. And as a teaser moving ahead,
The current numbers we have is about 108,000 people possibly shouldn't be on our rolls that are, and that's a big number, Mr. Chairman. Another cornerstone to SB 39 is chain of custody and vulnerable or compromised voter data. What we need to be working towards are things like multi-factor authentication, best practice data security protocols, which many of our most secure institutions already utilize. We've already gone digital, so talking about how scary that might be, we're already there. And we've already had data breaches, one in 2019, one in 2020. The voter, or the court system we just talked about, hacked this week, is going through this. So the digital world is here. We need to secure ourselves as best we can with modern technology, and that's one of the things. While it seems to scare some people, we're already here, folks. And the 113,000 Alaskans that lost their data, every bit of information in that was enough to ask for a voter absentee ballot and turn it in. And the currently Division of Elections accepts that data prima facie. They've admitted this on the record, and there's no cross-check. Just like the data they get from the Permanent Fund Division of Automatic Voter Registration, there is no cross-check of that data from the PFD Division to the Division of Elections. So we have felons getting registered. We have non-citizens getting registered. The PFD Division will kick them out when it goes through its protocols, but the Division of Elections does not. So we have people being registered that shouldn't be registered. We can do better than that. So interestingly enough, a recent Biden administration Department of Justice and CISA report actually talked about ballot chain of custody and multi-factor authentication as things the state should be doing to ensure and improve the security of our election integrity across the country. So this is a whole new administration that just came out and said these are things we could do, and we've already got that in the bill. Those are things we're looking at. We are also leaving it vague enough so that we're not directing a certain type of technology or company or anything else. We're looking at Division of Election goes, folks, we've got some areas we can improve upon. Let's do better. Let's find ways to do better and secure our data, because there are holes in this, and we've already seen this with some of the data breaches. In addition to things like multi-factor authentication, this bill requires the Division of Elections to adhere to, and this is really cool, actually. The U.S. Postal Service has the best practice recommendation for a vote-by-mail ballot chain of custody system. They already have it. By utilizing the U.S. Postal Service's existing ballot envelope barcode procedures, voters can account for their ballot anywhere it is in transit. Citizens should be able to track their ballot from the time it's shipped from the division until it's received by the voter, filled out, until they send it back. These systems also notify a voter if their ballot has been questioned, it can, rejected, and may even include ballot querying procedures. Many other states already do this. People can track their ballots from start to finish. They're like, why? If we can track our packages from big companies down to the nth degree where they are and when, why can't we do that with our ballots? It provides so many exciting opportunities. The platform for election security requires three critical pieces. Three. Data security, accurate voter rolls, and a qualitative secure chain of custody. Those are the things we started this journey on. We've learned much more, and we've learned where we have areas we can improve upon. We've learned where things are going okay. And our only intent has never been fraud. We didn't start that way because that's another myth that's been spread about this, so it's all about fraud. I can give you some of the things I got here today. You know, I got a letter today or a postcard, not, you know, there's no return address, and it, you know what it says? What are you without your racism? That's how it started. Ask me if I like dictators, and it's over SB 39. The lies and the things being spread by certain people and groups is ridiculous, Mr. Chairman, and it is absolutely inappropriate for folks that are actually trying to make it better and aligning with what other states and even the federal government suggests that we do to make it better, knowing that we are vulnerable. So these three things, data security, again, accurate voter rolls, and a qualitative secure chain of custody, knowing that we have some holes like what happened in October of 2020 with the data breach of 113,000 Alaskans' data being breached. I've already described what that data could be used as. The division confirmed all these things in the record. So SB 39 addresses these concerns and many others. It attempts to bring Alaska into the 21st century. We are working with the House on a bill composite that might actually take all sides of the aisle, as we've already changed, to address concerns on both sides to get us to a point where we may take that step forward. And I'm sorry for the long part there, Mr. Chairman. I basically just kind of ad-libbed that to get the whole thing out there in front, and I can stop for questions and then see what you'd like to do as far as moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Thank you for the patience of the committee members. Is there any quick, short debate on SB 39? We will be addressing SB 39 again tomorrow, 10 a.m. And at this time, I will set SB 39 aside. And unless there's other business before the committee, Senator Hughes.
I just want to say, I know we will hear this more, and I really appreciate all the work I've heard from a lot of Alaskans about that. I do think it's unfortunate. We've had similar problems with other bill where initial version comes out and people, you know, months later still thinks it's the initial version, and I just hope that Alaskans would be open-minded. I appreciate the fact that you're working with a House member, and I believe your intent is good, and that Alaskans should be open-minded. Thank you.
Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick response to that. We did find some fascinating discussion with a lot of different folks. Most of it was negative up front. Different groups spun up their groups and their chain mail. But what we found was over time it started to balance out, and now we're getting as many positives as negatives. And we actually had more positive public testimony for this bill in state affairs than we had negative. So I think it's fascinating, and it's not being represented fairly what the people think. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the time.
So once again, we'll have a out of the ordinary 10 a.m. Saturday morning Senate Judiciary Committee meeting. I'm also setting an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 11 regarding community property trusts at 11 a.m. on Monday, May 10th. Is there no other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is tomorrow, Saturday, May 8th at 10 a.m. We're adjourned at 4 p.m.